This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Thousands of unsuspecting Americans will soon receive letters from a company in Georgia called ChoicePoint, informing them that their identities have been stolen. The bulk of the victims are in California, but ChoicePoint announced today that the victims live in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and several territories as well. ChoicePoint says about 145,000 people have been affected so far, but law enforcement officials are warning the number could get higher and that this latest identity theft scandal is just the tip of the iceberg. The ChoicePoint case shines a light on a world that few Americans have thought about or even knew exists. It is the world of data compilers, companies that collect voluminous amounts of personal information on private citizens, social security numbers, credit records, dates of birth, tax assessments on houses. These companies compile it, package it, and sell it, usually for legitimate purposes, such as background and employment checks. But increasingly, for more criminal activities, some identity theft makes it possible for criminals to rack up enormous bills on credit cards and cell phones and commit crimes like driving while intoxicated and commit acts of terror and go undetected. So have you had your identity stolen? You are one of 10 million Americans if you have. What did you do about it? Do you think there should be tighter regulations over companies like ChoicePoint? Or do you think the government already has too much access to our personal information? You can join the conversation by calling 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Later in the show, we're going to take a look at the life of maverick journalist Hunter S. Thompson. But first, stealing identities. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Robert O'Hara, Jr., reporter for The Washington Post, author of No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society. And Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about ChoicePoint. What happened here?
Well, first I'll tell you a little bit about what ChoicePoint is so we can understand. In the 1990s, there was, in effect, a data revolution. The private information industry exploded right alongside the increases in computing powers and the networks. They amassed in 7-8 short years, they have amassed 18, 19, 20 billion records on virtually every adult in the United States, and they're not alone. LexisNexis, companies like Axiom, InfoUSA, they all have information about where we live, where we've lived our entire adult lives, the cars we drive. The list goes on and on and on, and this is a huge booming industry that affects every one of our lives.
So, and this was done mostly for our convenience?
Oh, the conveniences, we could go all day talking about the instant credit, the discounts that we get. There's data that's collected when we use FastPass on the toll roads. Mm-hmm. We love that. The ATM cards that we use so frequently. These information companies are really near the center of our information-rich economy. What happens, though, is that a lot of these companies have not taken as much care with this information as they need to. And how do we know that? Because there's been an explosion in identity theft. Information has been taken from these companies, or they've been tricked, these companies, into believing that an individual is somebody who they're really not. And as a consequence, credit reports have been left in tatters. People have been anxious. Mm-hmm. So this is a state of play.
How does my information get to ChoicePoint? I don't ever come in contact with them personally, do I?
No. The ChoicePoint and other companies like it collect information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, day after day after day. And they do it by buying records that are publicly available in many cases. The value of your house, the location of the house, the kind of car you drive, these kinds of particulars, and they're constantly refreshing that. And what they don't have and collect themselves, they buy from companies like the credit bureaus, which sell not credit reports necessarily, but information about identity information. They'll sell a billion records at a time to these information services. ChoicePoint is one of the largest. In the last 7 years, the story is quite remarkable. They spun out of one of the credit bureaus, and in the last 7 years, they've bought 58 other companies. Their market capitalization, the value of their stock, has grown from something like $500 million to over $4 billion. Mm. And they, as I said before, collect information and enrich it on virtually every adult in the United States.
Then who uses their information?
Lots of people. Police use it, local, state, federal law enforcement. We know that every major Fortune 500, virtually every major Fortune 500 company uses it to vet people who they're trying to hire. They debt collectors use it, private investigators, journalists. The list goes on and on. It's a valuable commodity. The problem is this information is flowing all over the place, and we may not know it as individuals, but our information is being trafficked like a commodity. The problem is people are getting this information who shouldn't have it, and that's what happened. That's what we discovered last week out in Los Angeles.
But when I go up to the webpage and I read the FAQ and it says, why is your transaction secure, I'm pretty sure that that information is never going to get out of the hands of the right people. How does that happen?
Well, ChoicePoint, to be perfectly sure, has systems in place to vet that you are, in fact, the man who claims to be the head of a check cashing business or a small insurance company. They go to the state, they make sure that that company exists, and they might do some screening on the person himself. Is this a real person? The identity thieves who appeared to be at work here took on legitimate identities and created the appearance of legitimate businesses by going to the state and getting the documentation, and then they got access to scores of accounts that allowed them to download information about, at so far, more than 100,000, maybe 145,000 people around the country.
We hear the word in connected with this, words like scam and fraud, and we think about it as criminal activity, but it seems to me that this is also ripe for, this could be a very serious national security problem. This particular theft could be a part of a national security problem.
I'm working on a few things that I can't go into detail about now, but identity thieves, pardon me, terrorists, we know around the world use identity fraud and credit card fraud to fund their activities. If you think about a terrorist cell that we're all becoming familiar with, Man's Fate, they've been doing this forever. Man's Fate, the great novel in the early 20th century, talked about terrorist cells. They operate independently, and one way that they fund their operations is through this kind of fraud. They'll charge a bunch of electronic equipment, they'll resell it, and they'll take the money and put it away for their nefarious activities.
Not only that, but you can, if you take on someone else's identity, I mean, if you take a look at how seriously we're taking identity, we're looking now at national identity cards, at using your driver's license to have that become sort of a national identity card. So if you take on another identity, you can get a security clearance, couldn't you? I mean, this could have even more far-reaching effects than funding your operation.
After 9/11, well, let me go back a half step. The data revolution was an extraordinary event that very few of us understand. It involved people, an amazing group of data geniuses, these people who figured out how to collect information and look at it very quickly with computers. The government embraced that data revolution after 9/11 in a way that's quite startling. And they did it because they needed to do just what you were talking about, to authenticate who Bob O'Hara is. Am I really a person? Am I that person? And am I do I pose some sort of terrorist threat? It's one of the salient national security issues that we face right now.
So, and the flip side of that is, so now there's these 145,000 and counting identities out there that could attach themselves to anyone. But the flip side is, as you suggest, law enforcement agencies have access to this information. I suppose the Patriot Act was passed, as you say, as part of this war on terror. Now, the primary author of that is Viet Dinh, and he expressed some concern about the government's expanded access to all of this information. I want to play some tape from your documentary, No Place to Hide. This is Viet Dinh. He's a former Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy.
In a democratic government, we should always distrust governmental authority. The amount of information that is publicly available to businesses about any individual is mind-boggling. I am not comfortable that we are where we need to be in order to circumscribe governmental use of private intelligence. The government alone can jail us, can investigate us, and can deprive us of life and liberty.
All right, that's Viet Dinh. He's the primary author of the Patriot Bill, the Patriot Act. He's concerned. Should we be concerned?
Pretty phenomenal remarks. Viet Dinh is a remarkable character. He's proud of his work on the Patriot Act and felt that it fell within the Constitution, but he, as he put it, outside the box. But to me, for a guy like that who's so informed, to express this kind of uneasiness. And by the way, he's a Choice Point consultant. He works for them and helps represent them and advise them. For him to express that kind of unease, I think, underscores with absolutely no uncertainty what we're facing here.
What kind of oversight or accountability is there once the government, for instance, accesses this information? What's the accountability procedure? How do we know they've accessed it, and is there any claim that we have a recourse?
Well, the core of the No Place to Hide radio documentary for public radio, but even more deeply in the book, is this idea that, in fact, by outsourcing this security imperative, by outsourcing to Choice Point, which in some ways acts as a private intelligence service, we lose a lot of the transparency that we as Americans expect of our government. You can't go to Choice Point and say, please tell us what the FBI is doing right now. Choice Point says, that's not for us to talk about. It's for our client. And when you go to the FBI, they will respond. They have responded to some degree to lawsuits from good government groups. But in general, it's very, very difficult to know how they're using this information service. And as far as I can tell, there's no audit trail.
Well, we're talking today about identity theft in the wake of the Choice Point scandal, and we're taking a look at it both from the criminal side, from the point of view of how inconvenient it is if you are one who has lost your identity, and we're also taking a look at identity theft as a possible national security threat, and what it means for civil liberties in the United States. It is a multifaceted problem. We're going to take a look at what the government is doing about that as we continue our conversation. I've been talking with Robert O'Hara Jr. from the Washington Post. We'll talk with Betsy Border from the Federal Trade Commission. When we return, as our conversation about identity theft continues, you can give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan, talking today about what the government is doing about identity theft and what you can do. Our phones are down right now at the moment. They apparently are taking the holiday as well, even though we're all here to do our to get this conversation underway and continued. So rather than call us right now while we're trying to get the phones fixed, you can certainly send us an email at totn@npr.org, and we'll see if we can call you back and maybe work things out that way. Our conversation today is about identity theft. Robert O'Hara is here. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, and Betsy Broder joins us now. Betsy Broder is with the Federal Trade Commission, Assistant Director of the Division of Planning and Information for the Bureau of Consumer Protection. Betsy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
How widespread is identity theft?
Well, we're hearing in the last week about maybe 145,000 persons who were affected by the Choice Point breach of data, but it really is much larger than that. We estimate in the space of a year between 9 million and 10 million people have some kind of identity fraud committed against them.
That's almost one in 30 Americans.
Well, when you look at the adult population,
it's even smaller than that. So how do we find out about this? When that happens to me, how do I find out?
Sometimes you find out in a very simple and straightforward way. You may get a bill from a credit card that you carry, and you see lots of charges that are not ones that you made. Someone else is spending your money. The only good news about that is that you're not held liable for fraudulent expenses. So you find it out in your bill, you contact the creditor, and you dispute those charges, close down the account, and move on with your life. But frequently, and unfortunately, it's much more complex than that. Maybe someone didn't simply intercept your credit card number, but was able to get access to your Social Security number, date of birth, maybe your mother's maiden name. And with that information, they could open up new accounts in your name. They can file for bankruptcy in your name. Perhaps they've made phony IDs in your name, or actually been able to get legitimate IDs using your information, and they're pulled aside for a criminal violation or a traffic offense, and suddenly there are arrest warrants out in your name.
And I've heard all kinds of horror stories about what it takes to reclaim your identity. It is an arduous process. What does one have to go through?
Well, it's arduous for a couple of reasons. First, Sometimes when you think that you've done everything that you need to do, you've disputed the charge with the creditors, you have contacted the credit reporting agencies that have all of this information about you, and you've disputed that, but maybe the debt had been sold to a third party, and you're disputing that, and so it comes up all over again. The other thing that's particularly harrowing about this crime is that once it hits you, you're never secure that you're not going to be victimized again. So how do you know, even if the suspect has been apprehended and convicted and put away, how do you know that your information hadn't been shared with an entire ring of people? So people who have been victims of identity theft frequently lose all confidence in the system.
Does the federal government have any role or foresee any role in helping people reclaim their identity?
The Federal Trade Commission is playing a central role there. We do not enforce the federal laws that prohibit identity theft. They're criminal statutes, and we're a civil agency. But we've set up lots of resources for victims of identity theft. We have a website at consumer.gov/IDtheft that has lots of information, first about how to minimize your risk of identity theft. But if you do become a victim, those important first steps to take so that you can minimize the harm and start recovering from this event. We train law enforcement. We go around the country with agents from the Postal Inspection Service and the Secret Service and frequently the FBI, and we train the first responders because frequently local police, which is the first place people turn if they're victimized, don't know that this is really a crime against the individual. They think it's a crime against the financial institution that's been duped. But so we're looking out on all fronts as well as talking to businesses on best practices.
We are taking your calls today as we talk about identity theft on the program, and we have a caller from Eli. Was it Illinois?
No, Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's what I thought, Charlotte, North Carolina. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question for us?
Well, yeah, I'm worried about protecting myself. I got a rather nebulous letter from my bank here in Charlotte that my personal information on my account number was in a database that had been compromised. Which alerted me that, you know, something serious was going on. So the bank was going, or did send me a new Visa check card, but they seemed to have no information about what had happened. And so when I went into the bank, they told me that they would not give me that information. I called their fraud office that had issued the letter. They told me that they didn't have the information.
Well, Betsy, let me ask you about that. I've heard this complaint many times that when I, as the victim, try to find out about what happened, everybody seems to clam up. Aren't they? Are they compelled to tell? Are the banks and credit card companies compelled to tell me what happened to me?
They're not necessarily compelled to tell you what happened to you, but there are new federal laws that make it easier to find out. This Eli is in something of a catch-22 because he knows his information has been compromised, but he's not quite sure what that information is or how it might be used. So what he can do is he should report this crime to the police and get a copy of a police report. And with that police report, he can go to his bank and ask to see any documentation that was used to fraudulently open or access his account, any of those transactional records. So the police report is important. He should also look at his credit report. He should contact the three major credit reporting agencies and let them know that his he fears he's a victim of identity theft, and he's going to look at his reports to see if there's any damage done in his name.
Okay, Eli?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
The other question this raises is what is the federal government's role in monitoring the exchange of this information? Any control over what Choice Point and others do with the information once they collect it?
Absolutely. There are federal laws. There are many federal laws that cover the compilation and access and accuracy of this information. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, Gramm-Leach-Bliley has provisions requiring safeguards for information. It's kind of different laws apply depending upon the type of information and how it is used. But there seem to be some, you know, areas that are not covered. And I think, as Robert was saying earlier in this session, in the last 20 to 30 years, there's just been an explosion in the compilation of data. And it's been a while since Congress has really looked at this issue holistically to see what kind of data are there and what consumers' rights are vis-a-vis that information.
We're talking about identity theft today on Talk of the Nation with my guest Betsy Broder from the Federal Trade Commission and Robert O'Hara from The Washington Post, author of the book No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society. Bob, what about that? Is the fact is computers and data compiling is here to stay. How do we protect ourselves?
it's here to stay, and it offers a lot of conveniences that we're not going to give up, and it's going to help us for national security, and there's no question about that. The problem is, broadly speaking, is it's way, way out in front of our understanding, and it's way out in front of the laws that do, in fact, exist. But there are, in effect, a hodgepodge of laws that are, I think Betsy and others would agree, are not up to speed for covering this accelerating data collection and use.
But look, the fact is, once there's, I mean, if you're talking about security, let's just take a look at securing the information, making sure it's going to the place you think it's going, where it's supposed to go, and no place in between. Anybody who tells you that they can build a system that's safe and secure and nobody can hack into is doesn't know much about the digital age, right?
Which is why the legal requirements are that they have reasonable measures in place to safeguard the information. Not absolute and not perfect, but reasonable under the circumstances. So if it's information that may not have a lot of, let's say, value, if it's just publicly information, people's names, we expect certain types of protections in place. If it's more valuable, more critical information, the protection given that information by those people who have possession of it is expected to be higher. So we do have an enforcement role on that front.
It's not just, that's exactly right, but it's not just how the information's shared, it's how it's used. So, for example, if a retailer accepts a name, which is as banal as it can be, and a social security number and maybe a driver's license that may or may not be legitimate as a proper authentication to then give instant credit, well, the information brokers aren't to blame for that, but have the retailers done enough to verify that somebody is who they claim to be? And I would argue that way too often, the people that we entrust with our information, the credit issuers, the retailers, the brokers, aren't paying the full cost of doing business by protecting the information.
Sounds to me, too, like the individual should, I should know every time my name has been given to somebody else. Every time somebody asks for my credit report, shouldn't I know that that happened and that it was given to somebody and to whom?
You can look at your credit report, and under new federal law, you're entitled to a free copy once a year from each of the three major credit reporting agencies. This is something that started in the West Coast and is moving east, so that by September 1st, everyone around the country will be able to look at your credit report, and you'll be able to see who's making inquiries. If you're even more concerned, you can pay for a service that will alert you every time someone looks at your credit report.
Talking about identity theft, and it's because this week thousands of Americans are going to get the disturbing news that their identities have been stolen. Some will have to face the arduous task of restoring their credit and perhaps clearing their names of criminal charges. Joining us now to talk about the consumer side of our story is Beth Givens. She's the director of Privacy Rights Clearinghouse and joins us from member station KPBS in San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you.
Beth, identity theft is a fast-growing crime, and I wonder what people can do to protect themselves.
Well, actually, to be honest, there is nothing you can do ultimately to prevent identity theft from happening. I think the Choice Point situation is a good example of that. However, there are many things you can do to reduce your risk, and there are things you can do to find out early on that if you're a victim of identity theft. I think the most important tip, and it's already been given by Betsy, is to get your credit report. Take advantage of that new annual free credit report. And if it's not available yet where you live, then order yourself one and pay the fee. Actually, seven states around the country through state law provide for free credit reports as well. So that's important. It used to be we would say order your credit report once a year. I think now it's better to look at your credit report at least twice a year. One thing you can do with the free credit report opportunity, there are three credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. Your credit report histories largely overlap, although there are some unique pieces of information in each of the three, but they're largely the same. What you can do is order, say, from Equifax today and get your free credit report from them. In 4 months from now, order from Experian, 4 months after that from TransUnion, and over the course of a year, you will be monitoring what's going on with your credit history. But in addition, you need to do other things. Clean out your wallet. If there's a social security number in your wallet, take it out and only carry it on the days that you need it. Only carry a couple of credit cards. Install a locking mailbox if you're in a neighborhood where there's been mail theft. That's a one of the primary ways that identity thieves have been obtaining the kinds of information that were obtained in the Choice Point heist. Shred papers that go out into the trash. When you sell or give away your computer, make sure you've wiped all that information off of it. Lots of things you can do like that. Be careful of phishing scams and also the telemarketing version of phishing. If you get an email or a phone call and somebody says, "Hi, I'm Tim from the security department of your bank, and we're just checking up and updating our records. Could you give me your social security number and your account number?" They also do that, by the way, by email. They look pretty legitimate. Do not ever give information, sensitive personal information, when you are contacted by phone or on email. The legitimate companies just don't operate that way.
We're talking today about identity theft with my guests, Beth Givens, Director of Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. Betsy Broder is Assistant Director of the Division of Planning and Information for the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the Federal Trade Commission. And Robert O'Hara Jr. is a Washington Post reporter and author of No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Beth Givens, tell us a little bit about who the people who perpetrate the fraud are. I've actually seen that in most cases we know the person who's taken our identity or maybe just our credit card. Is that true?
No, actually it's not. It probably, well, in a small percent of cases, it may be somebody that you do know. It might be somebody who has access to your personal information. In some cases, it's friends, relatives, home health care workers, people with access to the home. Some cases, it emanates from the workplace. There might be a dishonest employee or a temporary employee who gains access to the employment personnel records, of course, and those all have social security numbers, or who gains access to customer records. But in the majority of cases, victims don't know who did it, and that's because the perpetrators are getting the information by stealing mail, by dumpster diving, by getting it out of a workplace, in the case of Choice Point, by behaving like a legitimate company, like a debt collector, and gaining access through a subscription to a very rich resource, which, of course, Choice Point is. It's the ultimate data warehouse. So I think it was a Federal Trade Commission survey a couple of years ago that found that about half of all victims did not know how the perpetrator got their personal information.
All right. Beth, do you think the federal government is doing enough to protect us?
Well, you know, they're doing much better. We started counseling victims of identity theft about a decade ago. I think it's fair to say we were the first consumer organization to start working with victims. Federal Trade Commission, because of the passage of a federal law, became the Identity Theft Clearinghouse, I believe, in 1999, and opened up a wonderful clearinghouse with a toll-free number, multiple languages spoken to help victims, and with some excellent materials on identity theft, how to both reduce your risk and then what to do if you do become a victim. And that's all happened in the last 5 years. Are they doing enough? I do think the Federal Trade Commission needs to conduct an investigation of this Choice Point security breach. It's a very, very serious matter, and Choice Point's not alone. The data aggregator industry, as Bob said, is huge and growing. There are other key players. Choice Point's not the only one. And I do think more can be done in terms of watchdogging this industry, and also I think improving the regulation of this industry. The regulation, as Bob and Betsy have said, is spotty. And we don't have enough protection of all the different types of uses that are made of our personal information. It's kind of like, you know, the character Joseph K. in the novel by Kafka, The Trial. He knows that something's wrong, but he doesn't quite know what it is, and he spends a lot of time trying to figure it out. We're kind of in that fog as consumers. Tremendous amount of information about us is easily and readily available to others, both legitimate users and illegitimate users, and we need to have more control over what's done with our personal information. And I think the control is a key word. We at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse use the definition of privacy as the ability for the individual to control what's done with their personal information.
Well, and that leads to the question, what can we do? Is there any way that we can keep this information? And I'll put this question to Betsy Broder. Can we keep the information from getting to these clearinghouses?
I would say no, for all intents and purposes. In the most casual transactions that we conduct, we're producing information, data, that goes into the system. I would suggest that the only way you can prevent this from happening is by using cash, not using any kind of electronic medium, not using ATM machines, and perhaps living in a cave.
It's not possible And what people should realize is that there's more and more new types of information that are going to be flowing to companies like ChoicePoint. For example, in our lifetimes, I think the use of fingerprints is going to become universal or almost universal. Fingerprints, iris scans, and so on. And a company like ChoicePoint is already, for security reasons, for authentication, already starting to aggregate those kinds of identifiers.
Well, we can talk more about that and a little bit more about what can be done to protect your identity as our conversation about identity theft continues. Also later in the program, remembering Gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio, sitting in for Neil Conan. Right now, we're finishing our conversation about safeguarding your identity with Beth Givens of the Privacy Clearinghouse. We've also got Robert O'Hara from The Washington Post and Betsy Broder from the FTC. And Mike is on the line from Iowa with a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to relate. My mother-in-law actually was recently accused of identity theft. She accidentally, or she picked up somebody else's debit card in the line at the supermarket, bought gas with it, and then when she went to return it to the bank and tell them the story and have them transfer money from her account to the other account, they did that. The next day she got a call from the police accusing her of identity theft, and they brought her in and stereotypical cop drama stuff, pounding on the table and, we're going to hold you responsible for this. And while the lady said that she saw your husband in line behind her when she left her card at the supermarket, and we think you did this on purpose. Well, what sort of safeguards are there? What sort of provisions are there for a person who's been accused of identity theft like this? Obviously.
Yeah. Well, let's get a response, Betsy. That's the flip side of this problem. Thank you, Mike.
It's sort of interesting, isn't it, Frank? Because usually what we hear is the cops won't respond and they don't take this crime seriously. I guess where Mike lives, it's a little bit different. But she'll have to do what anybody does who feels like they've been falsely accused of a crime, which is to get an attorney and to establish her innocence.
Before we went to the break, we talked about the possibility that technology may be the way out of this. If technology is the problem, that there may be ways to safeguard ourselves and protect some of this information with even better biological checks, perhaps. Is that what's on the horizon for us, Bob?
The things you're referring to are biometrics, fingerprint, iris scan, face. That could be a great solution. If we all had to use our fingerprint all the time when we did a transaction, that could prove who we are when we got onto an airplane. And there are places, there are products that are coming out. There's something called VIP. It's going to be a private ID that uses a fingerprint. And by the way, ChoicePoint is one of the partners in it. So that when you use this card, you'll get into the fast lane and get into the basketball game or on the airplane more quickly than the rest of the world. Here's the problem with that. The way that we operate in the U.S. is that once a data system is created, we don't generally show much restraint with it. And in our entrepreneurial zeal, we always find other uses for information. If we came to a point where we had a universal biometric, a thumbprint, it's not going to be long before grocery stores ask you for it for your discount, that you have to use it at toll road. And suddenly the aggregation of data, the tracking of individuals, I would argue, is only going to accelerate unless we do the hard work of deciding what are we going to do with this data revolution, how are we going to get the most out of it, those wonderful benefits, without creating a sense that we're constantly being watched in a surveillance society.
Well, that sounds good, but I'm really sensing the shadow of the law of unintended consequences in this conversation. How do we get the benefits without any of the drawbacks of technology? And so, how do we do that, Beth? Is that what you
were going to say? I was going to say that the ultimate nightmare of identity theft would be if someone is able to impersonate you or spoof you via a biometric. Or let's just say that somebody gets to the identification databases before you do. Somebody uses your identity. Let's say you're a teenager and somebody takes your social security number and is the first one to apply that fingerprint under your name and social security number, but it's really them. I think the ultimate nightmare of identity theft would be trying to prove that, hey, that wasn't me, when there is a so-called biometrics-based system, and I think we're going to be seeing problems like that, unfortunately.
All right, let's go out to Minnesota, where Nat is on the line. Nat was on the line from Minnesota. Let's talk a little bit more about what can be done as we wrap up our conversation about identity theft. Betsy Broder, tell us once again about the FTC website and what we can do.
At consumer.gov/IDtheft, you'll find lots of tips on if you get one of these letters or otherwise believe that you're a victim of identity theft, the steps that you should immediately take. And just to run through them quickly, you need to contact the credit reporting agencies and make sure they put a fraud alert on your file. You only have to call one of the three agencies, and they will make sure that the other two receive the information, and they'll flag your file, which will indicate to a creditor that you're a victim of fraud and they shouldn't open an account without contacting you. You should also contact the creditors or other institutions where your accounts have been misused and dispute that those accounts and follow up in writing. You need to contact the cops. This is a crime, and you need to contact them so that they make a record of it, but you also want a copy of the police report because you can use it to effectuate other rights. And finally, you want to contact the Federal Trade Commission. At our website, there's an online complaint form, or you can call us at 877-ID-THEFT during the week. And we're going to take this information from you, and we share it with law enforcement around the country so that they're better able to see the whole landscape of identity theft and better able to investigate these crimes.
Beth Givens, very briefly, Director of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. Tell us about your website and how consumers can contact you.
Yeah, thank you. Privacyrights.org is our website. We have information on identity theft as well as the choice point situation. We also have information on how you can get that free credit report. And I'll just let me give you those numbers. This is a federally required right that you have. Annualcreditreport.com is the website that tells you, based on which part of the country you live in, when you can have access to your free credit report. But you can also call, and that number is 877-322-8228 for your free credit report, again, mandated by federal law. I do think that's probably the most important tip we can give for consumers today is take advantage of that free credit report. And in some states, California is one, Texas, Louisiana, you can actually freeze your credit report. And I think it's an example of a law that really needs to go national. The ability to turn off your credit report if you're not in the market for credit, that means that if the bad guys are trying to get credit in your name, they're not going to be getting access through the credit issuer to your credit report, and simply they won't succeed.
All right, Beth Givens, Director of Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, thank you very much. Betsy Broder, Assistant Director of the Division of Planning and Information for the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the Federal Trade Commission, thank you. And Robert O'Hara, Washington Post reporter and author of No Place to Hide, Behind the Scenes of Our Emerging Surveillance Society, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, a conversation about Hunter Thompson and his legacy. You can give us a call at 202-408-7544. Our phones are not working, so if you call us at that 202 number, 408-7544, or send us an email at totn@npr.org, we'll figure out a way to get you on the air for our conversation about Hunter Thompson. Stay with us.